Podcast Broadcast Network. This is Aaron here with John and Peter after a, let's call it an up and down week for the Oakland Roots. It's a pretty critical week, honestly. It was a very difficult 8 days, three games in 8 days stretch to have at this point in the season. It started off somewhat poorly, I think, right? With a 3-2 home loss against Colorado Springs Switchbacks, in which I think it's fair to say that Oakland held serve in the first half and then just could not keep up with Colorado Springs in the second half. And it's hard to know what to make of that, but they rebounded nicely away to New Mexico United. Anwar Pelaez got on the score sheet with something that wasn't a penalty. That was pretty exciting. And early in the second half, Trayvon Reed got on the score sheet too. And you're thinking, okay, these are two guys that Oakland really needs to succeed here. If these guys step up and start contributing on offense, that's going to make a huge difference for Oakland. They pretty much controlled that match until the end. And I think, Peter, you would put it like this in your preview of the Louisville City game, looking back at the New Mexico game, that through about 75 minutes, it was obvious that the man of the match would have been Danny Barbier because of his role actually in the buildup to both of the goals. But the last 15 minutes plus stoppage time made it clear that we had to at least give a nod to Paul Blanchett because he saved the Roots bacon time and time again. New Mexico did get on the score sheet in the second minute of second half stoppage time, but it wasn't enough because of Paul's heroics. And then Oakland goes on the road against Louisville City in a match that was, the margins were fine. Let's put it like that. Louisville City is a very good team. They haven't had the season this year that I think, you know, that they wanted, they expected. It's not been quite up to their standards, but it's still a very good team. And I would say that they were on top most of the game, but until the 71st minute, Oakland had the lead. Maybe due to some controversial refereeing. That's not really my place to say, but Louisville City did finally come out with the 3 points there with a Brian Ownby goal in the 71st minute, which happened to take advantage of one of the worst first touches you could imagine at this level of professional soccer. It was one of those things that it was so bad that he was able to capitalize on it because it wrong-footed Paul essentially in the box. Louisville got a last kick of the match winner from Oscar Jimenez. Oh, that was frustrating. I think they probably, on balance, might have deserved the 3 points, but the margins were really fine there. You know, one win and two losses with that stretch of games, honestly not that bad, I think. And I'll throw this open in a second, but let me just put my own thoughts on the table. Right, we had spoken about Colorado Springs this season in that, you know, one of the ways you could look at it is that they're maybe the third best team in the league, but they happen to have a 5-game stretch in the middle of the season where they picked up no points. And that is dragging down their overall record. And that's kind of what you saw in that match. The New Mexico match was brilliant. You know, I think for 75, 80 minutes, and you could almost attribute, I think, the drop off at the very end of that match to the fact that Albuquerque is really high up there. You know, the oxygen is very thin at that altitude, and it's a home field advantage for New Mexico. And I don't know, I'm not saying this is definitely what happened, but if you had two teams that had equal fitness levels and one of them's used to playing at altitude and one of them's not, you'd expect the one that's used to playing at altitude to have that extra gear in the last 10 minutes of the game. And then, you know, against Louisville City, I think finally what we saw, and we mentioned this in our last podcast, right, that the Oakland Roots are a very good team that don't have a lot of depth. And 3 games in 8 days, there's a number of injuries, right? Tamakis missed this one, not for injury, but he was on paternity leave. Nane was out. You know, you just look at the bench that we took to Louisville. It's your backup keeper in Taylor Bailey. Donaciano, who's still coming back from an injury. Danny Gomez, Ryan Herr, Anwar Pelaez, and Yesiel Cedeno. And he was on the bench because we were starting Wolfgang Prentice and Trayvon Reed. And, you know, the roster is right now about as thin as it can be. And three games in 8 days, happens to be on the road against a pretty good team. You can understand a loss there. It's frustrating because of what the playoff picture looks like. You know, Oakland is in the middle of a very congested pack, competing for those last two home playoff spots in the West. One win and two losses is not a recipe for keeping up with the other teams in that pack. And in fact, Orange County has now jumped out 3 points ahead of Oakland. San Diego is even on points with Oakland, but has a game in hand. So our position as, you know, with a home playoff game, the Roots' position there is a little bit more precarious than it was before this stretch of games. And unfortunately, the next one happens to be against Sacramento Republic, which is going to be rough. But at the same time, these were not dispiriting performances, I'd say. You know, they held their own. Sometimes goals happen, you know. At the end of the day, goals don't always reflect how the match is played out. I'd say all three results were fair, but goals change games. And, you know, sometimes you're just on the wrong end of a bounce, of somebody having a really good day. These things happen. It's not the end of the world. There's plenty of time. There's 8 games left in the season, but right now it doesn't feel like a missed opportunity. Hopefully it doesn't feel like a missed opportunity a few weeks from now. But John, let me throw this to you, because I think one of the things I'm taking away from this week is, and this came up in the match recaps that you and Jack put on the blog too, that Memo Diaz's role in this team, both offensively and defensively, seems to have grown. And I think that's in part the fact that Tamakas has missed a few matches, but it's also on merit, right? I mean, he's showing something, but his role in what this team is doing seems to have really blossomed in the last few weeks. And his ability to execute and stay on the pitch looks like it's going to be pretty key for the Roots going down the stretch.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I think that's big. One of the larger takeaways from the entire season has just been the elevation of Memo Diaz's game. I mean, you look at the numbers he's putting up: 3 goals, 4 assists. He's crossing with pinpoint accuracy. I mean, to the point that it is a big part of the game plan. I mean, he takes all the corners, most of the corners, but he's always over there to either they play it short to him or someone else, goes back to him, sends in a cross. He's over every free kick. I mean, you just see how important he is to Noah Delgado's system. And that's a credit to the personal work that Memo has done. I mean, he came here, he got a starting role initially under Farrell, lost it under Guerra, and then regained it again this year. And let's keep in mind that they signed an international left back to presumptively fill the starting role there. You know, you sign an international in this league, you assume it's going to be a starter. So for Memo to come in and show that he's the guy there, not just the guy at left back, but also the guy at right back when Tamakas is having a break, I mean, that's a testament to him. I know John Morrissey put him as in second team all league midseason candidate, and I hope he gets that because he deserves it. He's worked hard. He's been cast out throughout his career, coming from El Paso, where they told him, you know, you'll never get a starting job in this league, and he, you know, has stood on that, and now he's becoming a veteran. And, you know, one more season here. I mean, I'm sure he already has a voice in that locker room, but, you know, I think he still has a future past this season. I was talking to you guys. I think he could be potentially one of those long-term players that you see occasionally throughout the league. Some teams have those players who have been there for, like, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And I think he can be one of those players, him and Paul. But that's on the club to treat him right. So
hint,
yeah,
John, hint, hint. Wow.
When you say that El Paso said he would never have a starting role. That's the El Paso that he started for the Roots against in the 2021 playoffs when we eliminated them. That El Paso team.
Interesting observation. His goal against Colorado Springs, I thought, was fantastic. And Peter, speaking of defenders making unexpected offensive contributions, let's talk about Danny Barbier, who was like basically the left side at eight for much of the last week. It's unbelievable. And who would have thought that the solution to all of your midfield problems is just to put your center backs in the midfield? But it seems to be working, doesn't it?
The guy can ball. He's he moves so well with the ball at his feet. He's putting in good passes. I mean, he's obviously going to be like, I feel like he's surprisingly less of a threat in the box than you'd think for the fact that he's 6'9". But he is moving the ball well around the midfield.
I think it's a notable shift in tactics from this last couple of games that maybe is something they worked on in that 2 week, you know, summer vacation that they had. Defenders in midfield. I think we spoke maybe a few weeks ago about, you know, the fact that when Noah's system worked last year, he had a couple of guys who in that midfield pivot who were ball players in Rodriguez and Charlie Dennis. Not Rodriguez, Hernandez. And we don't really have that this year, and maybe Donaciano was intended to be that guy, but obviously he got injured. And the solution appears to have been to take our ball playing center backs and just move them up the pitch a little bit. And it's unorthodox. We're playing a back three, and we have four center backs on the roster, so it's not like there's a lot of slack there, not a lot of room for error. But they are providing, I think, some of the offensive spark we've been missing from the midfield. And I thought that especially against Colorado Springs in New Mexico, and I was a little bit distracted watching the Louisville game, so it might have happened then too, but I think it was Danny Gomez in those first two matches this week who was responsible for filling in behind and was doing an excellent job. Not much is getting through a midfield that includes Neville Hackshaw and Danny Barbier anyway, but Gomez was doing an excellent job rotating. Looks like it's something that could work. I'm less enthused, I got to be honest, and John, maybe you can comment on this. I'm less enthused about the Tariq Morad in midfield experiment. I think Hackshaw plays there for Trinidad and Tobago. He's looked very good there for us. I think him in central midfield is fine. I don't know what Morad brings in midfield that he doesn't bring in defense. You know, it seems like his qualities better serve the team in defense. And you would honestly rather have Danny Gomez or maybe even Ryan Herr in the midfield and Morad in defense than Morad in the midfield and I don't know, Nana in defense if he ever comes back. I mean, what do you think?
Right. Well, yeah, Go ahead. Morad has history at defensive mid, but he has looked ponderous on the ball this season in midfield. And I wonder if just years of playing in defense has sort of slowed that down, or if he's just sort of gotten a little older, or if he was never sort of the kind of defensive mid that Delgado wants. But, you know, I mean, he really has, like, Delgado has 9 of 10 outfield players make offensive contributions, you know, at any given time. And so you sort of can't, You can hide that in defense, but you can't in midfield. What were you going to say, John?
No, I just think Delgado's ability to mix and match these players in different positions is what I'm writing in for my vote for Coach of the Year, I guess. I don't know, because it is just it's everywhere, man. But, you know, it says a lot. I think Hackshaw coming up into the midfield kind of answered my call, at least for a midfielder who will line up a shot from distance and pull the trigger. And not just that, he's definitely a ball playing center back. So now you move that just up a little bit more. He sends those long balls in there. But you're seeing how Nane's injury kind of impacts that. And it's another interesting take where Nane, midfielder for every single game in his Roots career up to this point, before playing center back, and then he lines up there. You know, Tariq Mourad, every single minute he's played in a Roots uniform was at center back, until now, until Delgado said, hey, you know, you're going to move there. So, I mean, the coach is making it work, and that's a testament to him. That's a testament to the coaching staff, I think, keeping everybody well prepared. Maybe the biggest testament of all, though, is a player you just mentioned, Danny Gomez. I mean, you see just the elevation of him in this lineup. And I wrote after the New Mexico match, is he undroppable? Do you consider him undroppable? Because right now he has, supplanted himself as a key player, a guy who can make an assist and make the quick-witted decision on the volley to send the ball over the defense and catch a player that the defense isn't marking. He's shown he can make a tackle, turn the ball upfield, maybe not at the level of that you would see from Napo or from Hackshaw or Nane, but he gives you more defensively than, say, Donaciano, but maybe a little bit less offensively than him. So, I mean, to come in as a guy from the development team and say and get a spot as a starter, I mean, it's a testament to the coaching staff and being able to develop their players.
I can't believe that Gomez has over 1,000 minutes already, but has earned it. You know, I was worried when it was apparent that he was going to be starting sort of week in and week out with the injuries to Napo and to Koze, but he's been great. So I was looking this up. He and Reed and Prentice and Cedeno were all born within like 40 days of each other. They're all 23 and a quarter years old.
That's pretty fun and cool, actually.
The next youngest person on the team. Yeah, right? I mean, that's kind of a fun little core of guys. With Reed and Cedeno, I mean, Reed, I think, has been on an upward trajectory these last couple of weeks. The Roots need it to get better if he's going to keep getting a bunch of minutes, but I think he's looked better. And Cedeno is great. I mean, I Cedeno is a player I would want to see on the Roots next season. Prentice, you know, I think I have some frustrations with, but he has had some moments. Okay, so the next youngest guy on the team is Ryan Herr, who is also 23. I believe, if FB Ref can be believed. Yeah, Herr? Who do you think is the next youngest player, or the next oldest player on the Roots, after those five guys? So who is the youngest player on the team over 23?
It's got to be Johnny.
Yeah, I'm going to say Johnny.
It is Johnny, so I guess I'm the only person who thought that was surprising.
I mean, it is somewhat surprising, given he's one of the longest tenured players on the team. You know?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. But also, longest tenured on a team that's existed for, what, 4 years?
Yeah, but still, I mean, many of the guys on the team with Johnny in the Oaklandish kit days, I think, were in their late 20s or older.
Yeah.
I mean, that league was much more, I think, people who had washed out of other leagues rather than a stepping stone to other things.
Yeah. You mentioned, to bring this back to something earlier before we just get lost talking about how old other people are. It's not a conversation any of us want to have. He says, as his shoulder continues to bark from sleeping on the wrong side of the bed last night, that about 9 out of 10 outfield players on the Roots are expected to make offensive contributions, progressive passes, progressive carries, whatnot, in a game. But, and I think Jack put this on the blog, and I feel like we all agree with this sentiment. Like, this is also a very defensively minded team. On the one hand, it's cool to see all the defenders in midfield, making the roster look flexible. On the other hand, it's like, do we actually need to put all the center halves on the pitch at the same time? Like, is that the most exciting thing we can do? We've watched this team look so elegant, so play such beautiful football, but most of the time what we want to do is play it like that. It's like that that old shot of Stanford for back when Harbaugh was coaching, and they had like 8 offensive linemen on the field, and it's 8 offensive linemen, quarterback, fullback, tailback, and just ran it forward. And it's like you've got a team that is capable of playing like, this shows flashes of playing like, you know, a college football national champion, but they want to play with 8 offensive linemen on the field at any one time. College football started this week. If you don't know where my mind's been, the good stuff is next weekend, obviously, but where I'm going with this is, at the same time, right, you're looking at, you're talking about a whole bunch of people who are progressive, but when we've seen it, Delgado's system doesn't work with like pure defensive midfielders in that midfield pivot. It's like he's relying exclusively on outnumbering the opponent in the midfield to keep control of a match, with the two guys who are sitting there having the wingbacks press up. And I think usually you see the wingers kind of stay in the half spaces as well. And it just strikes me that one of the lessons we might find out that we've learned from this week is that if you can match Oakland's numbers in the midfield, you have a chance to really slow them down, right? I think ultimately that's what Colorado Springs did. And that's that home game against Colorado Springs is the one that worries me most looking forward about whether it is that one going to be a missed opportunity. You know, you want to defend your home turf. Now, at the same time, the Roots have been not great at that this year, and maybe it's a blessing in disguise that they get a road playoff win, if that's ultimately what, or a road playoff game, excuse me, knock on wood, if that is what ultimately happens, because their home form is a step down from the road form for sure. But I think Colorado Springs was just like, we're going to match you in midfield. And their two goals came from a midfielder. And I think the reason is that the Roots kind of got overwhelmed just because they didn't have the numerical superiority in the midfield. And I think what I'm saying is I'm curious to see how this goes in the coming games. I don't know how much we're going to be able to take from the Sacramento game. You know, they're head and shoulders above nearly everyone else in this league. It's incredibly annoying. But the stretch after that is going to be critical. Now that they've lost those games against Switchbacks in Louisville City, you know, where we thought they might have a chance to pick up points, that next stretch after that, Lights, Tulsa, Monterey Bay, you know, obviously those teams aren't going to roll over for the Roots. Monterey Bay is within shouting distance of a playoff spot. Lights are not. They're pretty bad, but
they played Phoenix tough for like 86 minutes though.
There you go. And Tulsa is sitting 1 point below the playoff line in the East. So they're going to be looking for whatever they can to get results from those games. And I'm curious to see if something was revealed in these games, or if it's like I said early on, you know, the Roots' lack of depth just showed there. And as Donaciano gets his fitness back, Tamakis will presumably be back. I mean, we might expect a drop off because the man's not going to be getting any consistent sleep at this point, but he'll be back on the pitch. Maybe something starts to turn for the Roots, and we just look back on this as, hey, this is what happens when you got 3 tough games in 8 days. I'm curious to see if someone else picks up on something that happened out there, because I think the most shocking thing to me from this week was how much control Colorado Springs had in the second half of that match. Anyway,
Let me talk about Sacramento. Sacramento are, where are they? Are they first or second? They are first, but they're tied with San Antonio on points. Okay. But so going back to the beginning of July, the last game they played in June, they beat San Antonio 3-1. Great result. No question. I think that put them firmly in first place, a lead that they have now ceded. Okay. Then they had three straight draws to RGV, Pittsburgh, and Memphis, all respectable results, but not none of them make you scared to go and play them. They then lost 3-0 to New Mexico United, which is bad. Like, New Mexico United are not good. They beat Phoenix 4-0, looked like they'd righted the ship. Okay, and since then, they are 3-1-1, which is good. But there are a 2-1 win over Vegas and a 1-0 win over Monterey Bay, which are not impressive results. A 1-1 draw against Birmingham, which is fine. A 3-1 win over Loudoun, which, setting aside the Roots turd against Loudoun, is not a great result. And then they just lost to Orange County, who are never going to lose another game, which is disappointing because the Roots have to play them. But, like, in July and August, Sacramento are... honestly, I don't even know if that's that many more points than the Roots have in July and August. You know, Sacramento is just sitting on all these points that they accumulated earlier in the season. And after, like, Russell Cicerone, after they had all these forwards that looked like they were running away with it, suddenly it's like they're kind of Russell Cicerone and then a bunch of guys who have scored 4 or 5 goals. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that I'm not excited to see Sacramento come in right now when you don't know what kind of product the Roots are going to put out there. But I don't know. I don't think I am as scared of Sacramento as I thought I was going to be when we started this podcast. And I started looking at their stats instead of listening to Aram.
Well, you make an interesting point. Actually, Oakland does have more points in July and August, 17 versus 16. So maybe there's something there. You mentioned this last run, potentially middling results against Vegas and Monterey and Loudoun. I think it's worth pointing out those were all on the road. I mean, that's a pretty bizarre thing to have that many away matches all right in a row. Vegas, Monterey, Birmingham, Loudoun. Obviously, Monterey is drivable, but you know that's not easy on the body. I wish I could explain Orange County. That it's just frustrating. But they have, I think the thing about Sacramento is they've kind of been, when you just look at their form, they don't look spectacular. But here we are with 8 matches left in the season, and nearly everything tells you they are one of the 3 best teams in the league, and it isn't even close.
Yeah, that's true. I don't really have a response to that.
Yeah, and, hard to disagree there.
And they've played Oakland already, and they kind of kicked our butts, which was pretty frustrating.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they don't have the best run of form. I mean, just like, I hate that they just lost 2-0 because now they're coming in hungry, in a big loss too. I mean, their Hughes Stadium anniversary, whatever fucking match.
20,000 people there to see them lose to Orange County.
Lost in front of 20,000 people, those fucking nerds. But yeah. but yeah.
They lost to the only California USL team from an even lamer city than Sacramento.
Battle of the commutes.
Yeah, don't tell this to, I hope Andy doesn't come across the podcast.
I think Andy understands how we feel about Irvine.
Yeah, he knows how we feel about Irvine.
Oh, was that it, John? I thought you had something else going there.
Oh, nothing to add, really. What about Sacramento? I don't know. Fuck them. No one likes Sacramento. The only reason to go to Sacramento is to drive through it.
Yeah, it's an easy place to get food on the way to Tahoe.
Exactly. Yeah, 8 matches left. Yeah, we're looking at Sacramento, Vegas, Tulsa, Monterey, San Antonio, Orange County, San Diego, El Paso. I mean, those are, you know, aside from Vegas, Tulsa, Monterey, El Paso, I mean, those are really tough. You look at those 4 matches that I just mentioned, and, you know, you look at them as must wins now. We're at that point in the season where, you know, we are starting to need those results. I think the target for John Morrissey for us, the expected points, was 52, which would put them at 4th. not third. I know. I mean, it's kind of hard. Like being up to third, it's like, oh, now we're like, oh man, third place. Got to get third place. You know, fourth place almost feels like a letdown, but it's like, oh, it isn't. Yeah, you're looking at those four matches, like, you got to get them. That's 12 points. And then, you know, Sacramento, obviously tough. I think you're very happy just to take a point there. And then you have, you know, same with San Antonio. I think you're very happy just to take a point there. The critical ones are Orange County and San Diego. Those are those 6-point matches. Those are, you're really looking at those as, this is a playoff atmosphere. This is, you know, this is a final. This is a championship game. And you have to approach them that way.
Yeah, these next five are, I think the next five are interesting in a few ways. These home games against Sacramento and San Antonio are going to tell you what's possible this season. If the Roots can get even 4 points out of that, all of a sudden, I mean, that means they'll have taken three from one of these teams. They're only 8 behind right now. I think anything can happen. That'll determine the ceiling. The other three matches, I come back to this. I think you've got to win those. Like, those are practically must wins at this point because of how difficult everything else is. And then you're right. You have this 3-match run in at the end of the season, which if everything goes as sort of we expect it over the next 5 matches will be completely dispositive of the season, which is a lot of fun, but also it's pretty nerve wracking. So let's talk about Sacramento real quick. Because that's who's next. Peter mentioned they are basically just Russell Cicerone. I guess that's unfair. Jack Gurr and Luis Felipe are also responsible for a lot of goal contributions, but really it's Russell Cicerone. I honestly have wiped the last Sacramento match from my memory. I don't remember what happened at all. I don't remember if they were on top the whole time, if they did something tactically. Couldn't tell you. I hope everyone else is going into this one with the same attitude. You want to beat them because they're the closest thing we have to a rival. And it would be really nice at this point in the season to get back those 3 points and put some heat on this team. I think that would be nice. Although I think, John, you make a good point. They're probably smarting and looking for some payback after that last match. So before we get to predictions, because I think the other thing that is worth talking about, that San Diego Loyal match to close the season, or second to last game of the season, will be San Diego's last home game. Which means that could be an emotional match. The Roots have had a lot of success down at Torero Stadium, but you feel like if someone's writing a script of this season, the Roots are probably not the protagonist in that particular match. I've said this, and now let me go back and make sure we set the stage. San Diego Loyal will fold at the end of this season, which is incredibly unfortunate. It's hard to know what lesson to draw from this, but it doesn't feel like any of the possibilities are good. You know, it appeared to like San Diego was going to be the first major market in which there was direct competition between the MLS and the USL. And San Diego Loyal lost the battle before it even started, which is wild since it feels like the MLS is looking to set up that battle in a lot of different places. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, it's funny though, because like you and I had this conversation, and the, you know, a lot of the places that were worried about that competition are about MLS next, and you know, I don't want to see, you know, I don't want to see Town FC get an MLS next team, and then suddenly see the Roots are struggling to sell tickets because you can go to a Town FC game and see, you know, Ben O'Nagle's favorite San Jose Quakes, like 17-year-old. But, you know, as committed as you get to a team, it's like MLS expanded to the San Diego market. Like, San Diego is not losing soccer here. They're getting a bigger team. And I don't know. It's like it sort of gets to the kind of tension between, like, I'm a soccer fan. I like my local soccer team, but, you know, like, I don't know. I don't know how to say it exactly. It's like the city of San Diego didn't lose here. You know, San Diego based soccer fans didn't lose here. It just, like, sucks that this specific team that you've gotten committed to has, like, fallen apart. But, like, they have an MLS team now. That's awesome. That's kind of, like, what we all want, in a way. Except to the extent that MLS kind of sucks. Like, it's run badly, but it is a higher level of soccer. So, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's... I've had a hard time deciding how I felt about it. You know, if an MLS team, like an actual MLS team, came to San Francisco, I would remain a Roots fan first and foremost. If an MLS team came to Oakland, man, how do you afford two season tickets? How do you, for like 7 months of the summer, how are you trying to go to two soccer games every week when they both play at like 7 o'clock? I don't know. I just, like, I understand if San Diego Loyal is having a hard time selling season tickets or whatever it is that made them fold. I don't know.
I think that the trepidation, though, that many people feel is not that a market has lost a USL team. It's that the USL as a league is a significantly better second division team. It's a significantly better second division league than U.S. soccer has had probably in its existence. I have a hard time believing that there was ever anything quite like this. And it's just not going to be possible to have an MLS that serves all of these markets. You know, we don't have any examples of any professional league anywhere in the world, as far as I can tell, but certainly not anywhere in America that's larger than about 32 teams. And that's going to mean that if MLS's desire to grow ultimately crowds out the USL, it means that there's going to be a dramatic drop in the kind of soccer you see in a lot of places. It might not be San Diego, but I mean, just think about our last opponent, Louisville City. If the USL folds, you think the MLS is going into Louisville, Kentucky? I mean, I just don't see it, you know? Yeah, and I think it's for soccer fans as a whole, it is somewhat problematic that it looks like there's evidence. Now, I think we are totally speculating, right? Right. It looks like there's evidence that maybe the MLS has such power in the market right now that the USL can't even hope to compete. And one of the reasons you worry about that is that the MLS has made noises like about their opposition to the US Open Cup, which look like their intent to kind of squash things down the pyramid that they perceive as even being remotely threatening to their model. I don't see how the USL and the MLS can't coexist, but then I feel like once you've tasted the money, you always want more. And I'm sure that the USL is preventing the MLS from getting more money. So I see that.
Yeah. And that's a good point. I see that they can coexist, but MLS clearly does not see that they can coexist. So that is a fair point. I mean, I am concerned about San Diego folding as a threat to USL because, like, MLS isn't putting a team in Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you see the example of MLS moving into cities, markets, and the teams effectively folding. I mean, Austin Bold was one. Who else? There's a couple more examples. But, yeah, I mean, you see it. That example as it is kind of scary where they can pick up markets and effectively push out a USL team to the point of, you know, non-existence. I mean, Miami FC, I don't see them with fans. I mean, I guess there's maybe the family. I don't know. But I mean, you see with San Diego, I mean, I'm not sure how much merit this holds, but they said it as the key reason to them folding is they need a stadium, and the rent at Torero was too much for them. And as Roots fans, yeah, and followers, we can definitely relate to that.
I think this is the other possible lesson to take here, and it might not be a USL versus MLS thing, because one of the things that stuck out to me in the video that the CEO or the president or whatever said, he's like, we looked from Oceanside to Chula Vista for space to put a stadium, for space to put a training center, for space for our academy team to play. We couldn't find it. And this might ultimately be, it's not comforting to say this, but this might largely be a function of California politics. It's nearly impossible to put an athletic facility of this magnitude somewhere without spending a lot of money, money we know that USL teams generally just don't have. And it's worth keeping in mind over the next couple of years, the Roots try to pull this particular magic trick off themselves, that that maybe the ultimate problem is just that, you know, and if that's the issue, then we don't have to worry about places like San Antonio, like Louisville, like, you know, Phoenix. You know, these places do have stadiums of their own. And I got to imagine that some of the places that don't, you know, like New Mexico, El Paso, these seem like places where that is something that might ultimately happen. So this maybe doesn't pretend anything about the USL or about US soccer as a whole. Maybe it's something that is much more local, an issue that's much more local, but that is certainly not going to be any comfort to Roots fans, because if it's a local issue, it's a local issue that kind of affects us too.
I think it was one thing I have been thinking about, at least, is, I mean, this means we need another West Coast team. Honestly, I mean, there's been a lot of East Coast expansion. There's been more plans for East Coast teams, Rhode Island, moving further to the Midwest, Milwaukee, who else? New Orleans has been discussed. Nothing much on the West Coast, and now we're losing a predominant team on the West Coast. So what does that mean? I hope that means we get one more team in the USL Championship soon, one more city somewhere.
Where would you put it?
I would put it in Long Beach. I think Long Beach would be a great choice. It has an airport. It's far enough from LAFC and from the Galaxy to have its own culture. Long Beach has its own culture, very much like Oakland. I think Long Beach would be a great spot for a team, honestly.
So first of all, bring back Reno.
Yes. I think Reno would be a great away day, underrated, but fun away day. Yes. Yeah.
And then you'd have a Nevada derby. But on top of that, I would propose Fresno and Bakersfield. Because, man, if you think I have opinions about Sacramento, let's go to the real Central Valley, the one represented by Kevin McCarthy.
And those are huge cities, too, from, you know, not from a California point of view, but from an American point of view. Like, those are huge. Bakersfield is like, what, the sixth or seventh biggest city in California, and it'd be one or two in probably 40 or 45 states. Maybe it's San Francisco, you know, if the mayor succeeds in putting a soccer stadium in downtown San Francisco. I don't know. There's probably some options up in Oregon too, right? There's a team in Portland, but what about Salem or Eugene?
What about Eugene? Yeah. You know, I think one untapped potential that USL could go into is targeting more college towns, targeting these towns that, you know, people are traveling, kids are traveling to from out of state in some regard. Eugene, you can even, I don't know, Boise. That sounds terrible.
Okay, but let's not go too far.
That sounds terrible.
Let's forget that John said Boise. The rest of that, your lips to the USL leadership's ears. All right, let's talk about Sacramento. Let's wrap this up with score predictions. Big home match. John, you start.
Oh, it's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a 1-0 Roots win over Sacramento.
Who's getting the goal?
Johnny, I will think starts. Hard to say. I think he's a starter. I don't think Pelaez is best suited for Sacramento. I think maybe Johnny's hold up play would do it. You know, we didn't dive into this, but I think maybe Pelaez would have been better suited for Louisville, just his speed. But I mean, hard to say after he came off the last game, in like the 60th minute. So, yeah. Anyways, yeah.
Peter.
1-1. Maybe a Mefeka goal. We haven't seen one of those in a little bit.
Okay, I'm going to go 2-1. You know, the last time we had a big match at home against Sacramento Republic, it was 2-1. I think we run it back. We're going to need a goal from somewhere unexpected. Maybe this is the game Danny Barbier makes his breakthrough.
You didn't say 2-1 who?
2-1 Oakland. 2-1 Oakland, yeah. Paul's going to be man of the match, obviously. He's going to make some outrageous save that preserves the 3 points. But maybe we'll get another highlight that shows on all the Oakland Roots commercials for the next 5 years.
Interspersed with clips of Wayne.
Exactly. So this is Pride Night this weekend at Pioneer Stadium. So this should be a lot of fun, and we hope to see you there. And until then, up the Roots.